This is Whitley Strieber. At the edge of reality, there lies an unknown country, a realm of mysteries and truths and the unexpected. If you do not wish to travel in this country, stop listening now. But if you hunger for high adventure and information that others dare not tell you, then welcome to Dreamland. Welcome to the edge of the world. And today, Dreamlanders, we're talking to Alan Lammers. Alan is calling us, talking to us from Bali. He has just been in Indonesia. And if you have looked at the followed unknown country, you'll find in the insight section an absolutely astonishing article by Alan about some things that he stumbled upon, really, in Indonesia that we're going to let him tell you about as we explore exactly what went on in what has to be one of the most bizarre and peculiar and frankly scary close encounter stories that I've ever heard. A lot of fascinating elements to it, and it is absolutely unique in the world. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Let's begin, if I may, by asking you exactly what you were doing in Indonesia.
I was stationed there for a year to help a local NGO develop community radio stations. And so I was asked to go to Makassar because my specialty is in broadcast, radio, television, and also information technology. I'm a media expert. So they asked me to go to a city called Makassar, which is in southern Sulawesi, on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia, to help a local NGO there develop community radio stations in order for them to be able to establish a more democratic, knowledge base, allowing people to communicate and talk and develop shows, that sort of thing. So it was actually a democratic thing, democratic human rights sort of thing.
And what is an NGO?
A non-government organization.
Right. Okay. So these are basically foundations and organizations devoted to the spread of democracy in this case.
Yeah. To put it as simply as I can probably put it, it takes up the slack where governments leave off. And usually they're funded by other nations, like America would have the U.S. aid, and in Canada, there's CETA, and these, and they have funds that they send to these local NGOs in order for them to develop knowledge bases or to develop community radio stations and that sort of thing. Hey.
So, and Makassar is in Sulawesi, right?
Yeah, Makassar is in Sulawesi. It's in the southern part of Sulawesi, also known as Ujung Pandang.
Do you speak the language? You sound like you do.
Yeah. Yes, I do, actually, yeah.
So you speak the language, and what drew you, because it takes a lot of work to become as involved in something like this as to volunteer. Were you unpaid or expenses or anything? Or?
Well, I was given what is called a subsistence allowance, and so that is not even close to what a salary would be in America or Canada, but it is enough that I can live here and do okay, because the money is about a 9-to-1 ratio. So for every $1 of American, it's worth about nine thousand rupiah. So it's quite a ratio.
So it's enough to survive decently. It's not like starvation wages or anything.
Oh no, nothing like that. Yeah. I mean, there are some other establishments that do that, but they're more activist oriented. I'm not.
Right.
What I did wasn't an activist sort of thing. It was an advocate thing.
And now the island of Sulawesi, it looks quite isolated on the maps that I've seen. And it is, in fact, quite an isolated area. You get there by flying from Jakarta or I guess.
Yep, you're absolutely correct. You have to fly to Jakarta, and then from Jakarta you go to Makassar from there. And it's about a 2-hour flight from Makassar, or from Jakarta to Makassar. And yes, it is quite remote, especially for foreigners. No, there's not. I was probably one of about 200 foreigners in a city of about 8 to 10 million. So that gives you an idea about how few foreigners are over there. So when you asked me if I learned the language, it was actually a matter of survival to learn the language because there isn't really anybody there that speaks English. There wasn't at the time.
No, I wouldn't think so. I mean, with a couple hundred foreigners, you'd be helpless without the local language.
Yeah, exactly. So these humanitarian organizations will send me to a school to learn the language, at least give me the basics. And then from there, I have to adjust to the dialect and all that sort of, you know, of the language and learn it, or else it's going to be a really hard time. It took me about 7 months to learn the language, but it was literally trial by fire.
Right, and I'm sure there was no Berlitz course or anything.
Nothing like that. There might be now. It's hard to say, but I never used it at all. And it's probably not very accurate. Like I said, there's about 8,000 different languages and dialects in Indonesia. And so the government at one time put together a language compiled of all of these languages so that the people on the islands were able to talk to each other. And it's called Bahasa Indonesia. That's what it's called. And Bahasa is actually a mishmash of even Arabic is in it and Portuguese is in it. And then the local dialects all rolled into one. And you have to do it that way. Otherwise, you can go. The funny thing is, in Sulawesi itself, there are 8 different languages on the island itself.
Wow. So what a challenge. And here you are all alone, essentially, out there trying to do something difficult to teach people about radio who probably didn't have all that much knowledge of technology, but probably enough to at least follow along with what you were doing. And you ended up going to a small village in the district of Sandu Batu. Why did you go there?
We went there to speak with the local leaders there because they wanted to have a they wanted to build a community radio station. There is a fair amount of illegal logging going on there, and they wanted to develop some sort of voice because they can't directly approach these illegal loggers, right? Because they're quite dangerous. So what they do is they build these radio stations, and then they start informing people, and through communications, eventually, I hate to say it, but eventually the governments and the police, they get sort of embarrassed and solve the problem is what happens. So we had to go there and build a community radio station, and there is no electricity in a lot of these villages. So what you have to do is you have to actually build what is called a river generator, and using the electricity from these river generators, then you can build the community radio station. So it's literally you're starting with a river and going, and the end result is a radio station. And one of the offset shoots of that is that the village itself will get some electricity also.
So now, how far are you from Makassar when you're in this village?
I'm probably about 10 hours away.
This is deep isolation then.
Oh, yes. The only way you can get there is what they call Ojek, which is on the back. They have like motorcycle taxis, and that's the only way you can get there if you want to get there fairly quickly. Otherwise, you can only walk there. There are no roads to these villages. And you will find this quite a bit in Sulawesi, where there are villages that are isolated in the mountains and in the jungle, that the only way you can get to them is by walking or riding these motorbikes, because it is literally just a dirt path to these places.
And when you did get there, what was it like? What is a place? It's fascinating to think. I mean, I'm talking to someone who has been so far out. I mean, this is about as far away as you can get in this world at this point, except maybe for some place deep in Siberia.
Well, this is a very interesting. I have a very interesting story about this, just to begin with. And I'm a Native American. I'm Aboriginal, and so I'm probably one of the few, if not the only Aboriginal that has ever been to that part of the world. And so I went there, and they have a story that 10 or like a part of their tribe left the village and went off to sea in that. And they have been always waiting for these people to come back. This is a very, very old story. And when I went to this village, I was actually shocked at how some of the stories of Native American stories and their stories were similar. There was a lot of similarities. And strangely enough, yes, and another thing that was very unusual is that they have the high cheekbones, which are characteristic of Native American people.
And the you're a Native American, and you happened to end up in this place. Do you feel like there was something more going on there that would have drawn you there, perhaps?
Well, they opened their arms to me up to me right away, and they were very friendly, and all of a sudden they started telling me that they were suspecting that maybe I was one of the family that was trying to return, that returned, according to their legends.
How fascinating. You know, so tell a little bit about this legend.
Well, this legend that they have is that there was a little bit, not a dispute, but there was a disagreement within the tribe. And that some of them wanted to go and explore the rest of the world, and the other ones kind of wanted to stay. And so these people told the part of the family, because this is all just one big family when you're in a tribe. It's a family. They call it Kalarga. It's family.
Right.
Half of their family left and went into the sea. You see, the Bugis are known as great sailors. They were great shipmen. And that's where we get the story of the Bugis man, or the Boogeyman. That's where it comes from.
Really, tell us more.
Yeah. The Boogeyman,
why would the Boogeyman, why would he be scary? What makes them frightening?
Well, the Dutch were running Indonesia back when it was Indochina. They called it Indochina. And the Dutch were controlling that whole territory. And of course they would come in on their ships. That's the only way they could get to these places for the spice trade. They controlled Indochina for about 350 years.
Right.
Now the Bugis, there's what is called the Bugis people here. And they're a fierce people. They are great. They're fearless, and they don't have a problem at all with sailing as far as they can. They have these wonderful boats, these tall ships that they make. They call them Finisi, and they're huge. They're literally these tall ships with big sails, and they look like something out of the 14th, 15th century. They're 16th century. They're very old and very beautiful. They still make them to this day. But anyway,
absolutely, well, Alan, we're going to have to take a little brief break here. Listeners, do you know or have you experienced a similar story to the ones that we're talking about today? Are you familiar with isolated parts of any country where this may be happening, or do you have something to contradict such a story? Let us know. Write Whitley@Strever.com. And subscribers, if you're coming to the Dreamland Festival, think about getting your tickets soon. There will not be discounted tickets sold at the very last minute, and it's always possible that this may sell out. It has done so in the past.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. This is the Edge of the World.
We're talking to Alan Lammers. Alan is a Native American. He is talking to us from Bali, from the Alan Island of Bali, where he is presently living. And we are talking about what is going to turn out to be, as we get it deeper, one of the most remarkable stories of close encounter, possible close encounter and abduction you have ever heard. Now, before we left the air, we were talking about the people, the Bugis people, who have given their name to the Boogeyman because they are so fierce and they frightened the Dutch so much. And they built enormous ships that they were able to sail all around the Indonesian archipelago with. So go ahead, Alan.
Just to pick up where I left off. So what would happen is these Dutch ships would come into port. And, of course, they're not really friends of the Bugis. It was a bit of a war going on. Well, the Bugis were very capable of quietly sneaking up to these ships, and then they would attack these ships at night and take over the ship, kill everybody on it, and take over the ship, basically. And so what would happen was that the captains would say to their ship mates and everything, that to keep your eyes open or the Bugis man will get you. And that has transferred, that's translated over time to you better be a good boy or the boogeyman's going to come and get you.
How fascinating. So it comes from somewhere, from the old colonial days when these people were fighting colonial domination.
Yes.
Now, let's talk a little bit more before we get into what is happening there about the legends that are, that you found a parallelism, a similarity between legends in the Bugis culture and legends in Native American culture. Could you give us some examples?
Well, one of the most fascinating thing that I'd ever heard of about American Native culture, and a lot of people don't know this, is that there are many cultures in Native American culture that believe that they originally came to the land on the back of a turtle. And if you look at the back of a turtle, it's very much shaped like a huge saucer. So I'd always drawn to the conclusion that they actually literally came from somewhere else. And these people in Walla Walla, in the village of Walla Walla, have that same history where they said they came here on the back of a big sea turtle.
You mean in Walla Walla in Indonesia?
In Indonesia.
And, of course, there's a Walla Walla in Washington, too, that's named, it's an Indian name.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so there's all kinds of similarities. That's just one of them. They told me the story about the white buffalo woman, but they don't call it the white buffalo woman. It was a woman that came and showed them how to make peace amongst all the tribes. And that's a similar legend that occurs in the Sioux legends.
It sure does.
The white buffalo. Yeah.
Gosh. You know, Alan, talking to you, it's really mind-opening because I'm realizing as we talk that we know nothing about how this world really works, that this Eurocentric culture has made certain decisions about what must have happened in the past because it's what they think is logical, and it always rolls around the same thing. Europe did it best, and yet one gets the feeling that a very ancient and much more subtle, perhaps, culture, one that is so subtle in its way of addressing the human spirit and the human mind, that Eurocentric people like me have a very difficult time actually understanding it at all. And yet here it is. But let's go on now. Here you are in South Sulawesi, in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. What happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I work with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow. And, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear. And I thought, well, that's rather a harsh way of dealing with people.
Yeah.
Break a taboo. You know, I thought, well, I mean, because that's what we use that term here, right?
Right.
And so I thought, well, okay, that's pretty harsh. But, I mean, I guess I'll follow the rules. And I mean, every part of my, everything I wore was black. I didn't mess around at all, and that's what I went and looked for, and that's what I took with me. And so we went to the village, and sure enough, people were dressed only in black and white, a little bit of white here and there. I never thought much more about it, you know. I kind of pushed them a little bit about why I only wear this, and they said, well, you can only wear that color into the jungle. You don't wear any other color, especially yellow or kuning. They call it kuning. Is the word for in Bahasa for yellow. And so we proceeded, just to cut short to the story, the next day we went out into the jungle to look at some of the illegal logging that was happening in the area and how we were going to deal with it. And they wanted to know our opinion about how to deal with things, how to deal with this. Now, there was about 8 or 10 of us. There was 10 of us that went out, and we went through the jungle, and we spent the whole day, and we mapped out where we were going to put some, where the best place to put a generator was and all that sort of thing. And I noticed that one of the guys that were with us, he's a Makassarin, and he had yellow soccer socks on, big, thick yellow ones, and they went right up to his knee. And we all wear pants in the jungle. You wear pants. You don't wear shorts in the jungle.
Oh,
you
of course.
You're going to be in deep trouble, okay? So we were all wearing pants to cover this up, and he went in with these bright yellow socks. And I looked at it, and I noticed it. I mean, you can't miss a sock that color. But I didn't think much more of it. So we proceeded to go through the jungle, and I proceeded to get covered pretty much half of my body in leeches. And they thought that was pretty funny, and I told them that, you know, maybe the leeches, they're like ethnic food or something. But we kept going. And later that night, we come back, and as we were coming back, he was very quiet, and he didn't speak very much. And he usually is very talkative, but this time he was very subdued, and he just kind of was quiet, and we went back into the house and just spent the time to eat supper and everything and just did what we usually do. And within about an hour or two, he started getting violently ill. And I excuse the viewers or the listeners.
Go ahead and tell us. We're interested in every detail.
But he projectile vomited. Like, I've never seen a human being projectile vomit before. I'm talking 5 feet. I mean, extraordinary.
Wow. So he was almost having like a vomiting fit.
Yeah, he was having seizures. And it was coming. I've never seen a human being have his body rattled so hard by a sickness. And I thought at first, oh my God, he's got malaria or he's got, you know, something, right?
Yeah.
So we proceeded to, I actually tried to make him healthy again. I spent a lot of time to develop it, trying to think of medications that would work for him to keep his fluids up, to keep him going, we kept massaging him to keep him alive and all that sort of stuff. And he managed to stay alive the whole night long. The next day, he recovered, and he was his old self again. And we said, what happened? And he said, I was very embarrassed to tell you yesterday. He said, because I wore yellow socks into the jungle, and I know that was not allowed. What happened was something, and he couldn't see it, bit him on the back of his calf on his left leg. I thought it was right leg, but it was his left leg, and bit him again in the back of his thigh.
And this was not seen. You were all together when this happened. You must have been.
Yeah. Yeah,
we never saw a thing. No one
saw a thing. No one saw. He didn't see it himself. He couldn't see it. He just said he felt something grabbing him and biting him. And
notice him reacting to this at all during the day?
Well, we heard him holler a couple of times, but sometimes that happens. You just holler.
Yeah, it's the jungle. I mean, yeah, you might be getting bitten by a beetle by some kind of a creature. Okay, so he hollered a couple of times, and then he shut up.
Yeah, and see, you have to understand that, I mean, I came out of the jungle, my legs from about the knee down were black with leeches. Because there's huge amounts of leeches and stuff that glom onto
it's,
you.
It's so, a hard environment, a very difficult environment, obviously.
It's a type of environment that is so beautiful that you can just hardly imagine it, that there's danger to this place. It's almost paradise. It's like, but it's also very dangerous, and you have to be very careful.
Danger in paradise. That's the Garden of Eden. It happens to be a death trap.
Absolutely, okay. It can be.
Well, we're going to take, Alan, we're going to take another little break here. Folks, this is so annoying. I hate to do these breaks. I'm tempted to just go ahead with the rest of the show, and maybe I'll do that, but because this is so absolutely fascinating. Okay, we're going to take our break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online.
We're talking to Alan Lammers. He's talking to us from the island of Bali in Indonesia. He's just taken us to a little village out in the jungle on the island of Sulawesi. He was wearing, as told by the warned by the local people, only black, for fear that if he wore anything else, he would disappear. One of the people in the group wore yellow socks, knee-length yellow socks. He was bitten by something that he could not see on his calf, left legs, and his thigh. And then that night became so ill that he projectile vomited. Then he recovered the next morning and admitted that this had happened. And Alan, did you see the marks?
Yeah, there was marks, but they were more like big scratches than bites. There was, you know, not usually that crescent shape to a bite or anything like that.
Right.
They were very unusual. I've never seen anything like this before, right?
Right.
And so we examined it a bit, and I kind of thought, well, I mean, I don't know what this is. And the rest of the group kind of wanted to get on with things.
Did he look like he'd been scratched with claws? Was that the appearance of it?
Yeah, they were furrows a bit, but they were three. There were three.
Three furrows.
Yes, like in groups of three. So they didn't look like a bite at all, but he said it felt like a bite. So it was something that grabbed him, I think, more than anything. But anyway. We proceeded to talk with the rest of the village, and we were kind of wondering what happened. And the village the people in the village were kind of like standing around, and they were sort of like almost like they were used to it occurring once in a while, and they're very polite. They would have never told this guy, get those yellow socks off now.
Right.
You know, they would have never said that, right? So they said to him, they said to me, you know, he was very lucky. And I said, he was very lucky? He says, yes. He says, usually the people disappear.
And they disappear.
Oh, yes.
They disappear completely.
Completely.
Nothing is ever found.
Nothing is ever found.
Oh my God. Go ahead.
And I said, it finally hit me. This is what when the guy said, people who wear bright colors disappear. This is what they meant. They actually disappeared. That it wasn't some harsh treatment for a taboo, for breaking a taboo. This is what actually happens. So I talked to the rest of my friends. Now you have to understand, I work with engineers. I work with doctors. I work with these kind of people, right? These are educated people. And they would tell me, yes, this happens a lot. Very much so. It happens very commonly that there's entire cultures that have developed a culture under wearing only black. There's a culture called Kajang, and it's in Bulukumba in South Sulawesi. They only wear black. They wear no other color. And that is because they can't go into the jungle wearing any other color.
Not even white?
No, they don't even wear white. Very small.
And how long do you have any sense of how long this has been going on, like from time immemorial, or?
Apparently, this has been going on for quite a while. It's been going on for some time. That something has been taking these people, and it's been happening. Let's put it this way, Whitley. It's been happening so long that they've adjusted to it, adapted to it, and are resigned to it. That this occurs.
Do people who wear black in the jungle ever get taken?
Yes, but you have a better chance of not being taken if you wear black. But whatever these are, will take them. Now, I thought maybe it was a snake.
Yeah.
Because the largest snake ever found in the world, the Guinness Book of World Records snake size, you know, was found in Sulawesi. So I thought, well, maybe it was snakes. But they kind of, no, it was, it's not a snake. I said, well, what is it? And they said, it's the djinn. And I said, the djinn? Yeah, that's the
Muslim, the Middle Eastern tradition of the djinn actually predates the Muslim religion for very much. But the idea of the djinn, and the djinn is a, go ahead and tell us.
Well, they use the word djinn because Sulawesi is 85% Muslim. So
right.
They will use that term. They also use the term, which is a more local call, called kachachi, which means little person.
Have any of them ever seen these creatures?
Well, that gets me. They have seen them. Yes, they get spotted once in a while. They do live. They say they live in the mountains. They say that because that's where they're found. They don't actually know if they live in the mountains, but that's where they're in the mountains in the jungle, and they just come down and they take. So I asked for a description, but I'll get to that story next because this is much more recent. Now, fast forwarding a bit till I come back, I got here just a little while ago, and a friend of mine, I went to go visit and spend some time with, and she told me a story about her cousin who lives with her. And about on January 31st of last year, they decided to just go mountain hiking, and which is common there. Everybody does it. So it's normal. So there was five of them, and they went into the mountains to spend a few days. They brought 3 to 4 days worth of food with them. It was just like a normal outing. They had not heard from them till about, turned into about the 12th of February, and none of them had returned. And so they sent out search parties for them. And you have to understand, the reason why it took them so long to develop a search party is because the people have to put together the money in order to pay for a search party.
It's not something that's done by the government there like it is here?
Not really, no. There is a little bit, but even the government will sometimes want you to pay for it. Because in their mind, you took the chance of going onto the mountains, you know, it's you know, you're going to pay for that, right? They don't want to foot the bill. So the family had to put together the money for it, and then they could put together and look for them, the search party, and look for them. And they finally found her cousin. The other ones were missing. What little bit the cousin can remember of this time, when they found him, he was emaciated. He was a very skinny, he couldn't even feel problems. He hadn't eaten for a long time. He managed to live. Luckily, it's a moist and humid part of the world, so he could find water, and he survived
right.
on that, and what little else he could find. But he was in very rough shape. But they finally found him in March, on the 4th of March of this year. And he started talking about what happened, and he has these memories of seeing these little people following them. And he has memories of them, of being around water, and then he has memories of seeing animals he's never seen before.
Such as?
And then there are these big animals. They're almost the size of horses with huge antlers. The closest I can think of that we would find in our area is like caribou or reindeer or something like that, right?
It's certainly not in the Indonesian jungle.
There's... if there is anything like that, it hasn't been found. It's not, you know,
right.
So we're at that. And he remembers seeing these different areas in that. And he also remembers these little people. And so I said, well, can you draw me a picture? Well, he's not an artist, but he did the best he could. And what he did was he drew this picture of a being with small black eyes, a very small nose, almost non-existent, but a grin, a mouth that is hugely broad. And it distorts the whole face because it's so large. And even just seeing this thing as a almost like a happy face, you know what I mean? Just as a all yeah. stick. It was eerie to see this thing. And apparently when they smile, their smiles are huge, their teeth are huge, and it's like they're almost like Cheshire Cat. Like, you know, like
how very upsetting that would be, boy.
Yeah, and they're extraordinary looking. I asked him what color they were. Does he remember a color? And he couldn't tell me what color. He couldn't remember what color they were. Now, he was so traumatized by what happened to him that it took him months to just talk. He couldn't talk for the longest time.
He couldn't say anything. He was just mute?
He was mute, yeah.
Good
he was so traumatized,
Lord.
He was mute. He's only been able to talk about this fairly recently. I'm talking the last few weeks.
So this happened when? This happened recently then?
This happened this March.
In March?
Yes.
And
they found him in March.
And where exactly did it happen? Where precise place?
There is a place city called Palopo in southern Sulawesi. It's just above an area called Taraja, which is famous. It's a famous place because of the way they do their funerals and the way they bury their dead. National Geographic has done shows on them and that sort of thing. And what Taraja, so anyways, what Tarajans do is they sacrifice several buffalo and they sacrifice several pigs in a funeral, and then they hang their dead on the side of cliffs, right? And it's famous for that area. But Palopo is a city that's just north of that, and it was just an hour north of Palopo on a mountain there.
So, okay, so we're getting an idea, and folks, you can look on a map of Sulawesi or Google Palopo, Sulawesi, and I'm sure you'll be able to find the region where mm-hmm. this happened. It might be very interesting to look. You can even look at a satellite view of it these days. Might be
yeah.
very interesting to take a look and see what you can see. But go ahead.
So that's the mountains where they were found. And apparently this mountain that area is famous for these beings. They are around there quite a bit. And there's all sorts of other things that happen in this area too.
But like what sort of other things? So, we're going to take a little brief break and then we're going to get into this area, folks. We're taking a journey into another reality here. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. This is The Edge of the World.
We're back with Alan Lammers talking about some extraordinary events and some extraordinary creatures in Sulawesi in Indonesia that apparently have been around for a long time. And since the story he's been telling about a man who disappeared while hiking along with a group who were never found again took place last March, this is still happening big time. So go ahead, Alan. Let's continue now.
Well, if we look a bit at the timeline about when they left on January 31st and when he was found on the 4th of March, that's 3 months.
Right.
And you can't even survive 3 months. You can't survive 3 months with no food.
Yeah.
So my question is where was this kid? I don't know where he was.
And
how he managed to live.
He doesn't either, does he?
It's very spotty memory. Apparently, this is common when you meet these beings, that the memories will be wiped clean, and people have a hard time remembering them.
What bits of memory has he come up with?
He has the memories of them trying to show him how to save one of his friends who got very sick, and he has memories of them talking to him and telling them things. And
did he tell you any of these things?
Yeah, he. I'm still digging what they said to him out of him. He's very reserved about that. He doesn't really want to remember, to be honest with you. And so it's hard to get this information out of him, so I'm still working on it, okay? I managed to record some of it on tape, and the reason why I say some of it is a fresh bunch of mat trees while I was recording went dead, so I have to go.
That's a familiar problem. So there's something,
yeah.
this presence was right around you while you were recording this. Otherwise, the batteries wouldn't have gone dead.
Yes, I think so. I think it's around me.
Lord.
So I'm sorry if I'm jumping all around.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We're here to listen.
So you may feel like you're jumping all around,
but actually, when you listen to the whole interview, you'll find you told a very coherent story very nicely in stages. You just didn't realize you were doing it, because I've been doing my end of this for a while, too. So let's keep on now. And let's just, okay. if you will go back, can you tell us anything that he said that they may have told him?
I think they just basically trying to tell him how to survive.
So they're not hostile then?
No, they will take people, and sometimes they bring them back, and a lot of times they don't. And nobody knows where these people go. Nobody has a clue. And they are very secret. Another thing, there was one more attribute about these beings that I found very interesting. They move very, very quickly. Almost like they appear and disappear and then reappear and disappear and reappear. And it's like Indonesians are fast-moving people themselves. So for them to say that these things are extraordinarily quick means that they are very, very quick, these beings. They can move very quickly. And so what he remembers is they're coming in very quickly, saying things, looking after him a bit sometimes, and telling him how to, you know, to make sure he drink or to try to help his friend, and then they would disappear. And that this is near the end of his journey with them, right?
We're having a little audio problem in through here, but this call is coming all the way from Bali, so we just have to live with it. Let's hope it backs off a little bit. You broke up there for a couple of seconds, Alan. Could you say what you just said again?
Another attribute of these beings is that they move very quickly.
Right. Yeah, we heard that part, and then after that.
And he remembers near the end where these things would come in very quickly and give him a few bits of advice to survive it. I think they wanted this boy to come back. This one they brought back. It's just that when they brought him back, it seemed to me that what they were doing was they were trying to keep him alive also until somebody found him. They were waiting for somebody to find him. So they would keep coming back to him afterwards to make sure that he was going to live.
And so he ends their message ends up on what is arguably the largest show in the world about this subject.
Yeah.
Dreamland.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so the thing is, that's going on here is that there's another story about a man in this Palopo area who was on a boat on the river, and there are crocodiles in this part of the world. And apparently this huge crocodile attacked his boat and turned it over, and they thought the guy was gone. About 2 weeks later, he showed up at the door of his house and completely terrified the village. They saw him get torn apart, what they thought got torn apart by this crocodile. And he shows up at the door with nothing wrong with him. And he tells them that these Kachachi saved him, looked after him, and brought him back. They healed him. This is another story.
So on the one hand, you have somebody getting bitten and being made terribly ill and people disappearing. And on the other hand, you have this boy who seems to have been intentionally allowed to come back and a man who was healed after being attacked by a crocodile. What does it add up to you in your mind?
Whatever these beings are, they're not just malicious. They strike me as intelligent, that there is some purpose to what they do, that they almost treat these people like they're theirs almost. It's kind of, there's this symbiotic relationship, this give and take that goes with it. That sometimes they take these people and they never come back, and sometimes they bring them back and they either give them a message or they're used as an example of these to keep the memory alive.
How this very strange.
And they call them Jin Kutachi. because they don't know what else to call them. And they're very.
What does that translate into?
Little demon.
Little demon.
Or little genie. Or jinn also means genie.
Little yeah, genie. Little unknown beings would be the best maybe way to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the best way to put it. Because they just can only use what words they're, that they have. They have their local dialect stuff, but it's, so it's a mixture of the two, hey? And now, were you going to ask me a question?
Yeah, I was just getting ready to ask you how you feel about your role in this, because it seems to me that, you know, you've become a conduit for them. You're involved.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that I seem to have been brought into the story a bit. And I guess if you really want to look at serendipity, here I am talking to you about it. Probably
right.
One of the very, very few times this has ever been talked about in the world.
In the world. And, of course, you're talking to somebody who is not only, you know, going to believe you, and is gonna, but knows how to ask questions about this, because it's been in my life, and I've had hundreds, thousands of cases brought to me from around the world. And not only that, I've actually seen something once that looked like what you describe. And I woke up one night in my cabin in upstate New York, and there were three of these things standing on my bed. They were short. They were 3.5 to 4 feet tall. And they were just like he described, with these huge mouths. And they just scared the living daylights out of me. I yelled and jumped up. I believe that was even one of the times it woke up my wife. And they were gone just like that. I never saw them again. They didn't do anything to me. But I know they exist because I've seen them with my own eyes. And they certainly range far from Sulawesi at times.
Well, yes. And it's a bit of a personal story with me, too.
Because tell a story.
I've been interested in the paranormal. I've been searching pretty much most of my life on the edge to find answers about things that I experienced since I've been a very, very, since I've been a child, like 3 years old. I have memories of fighting this little being that was trying to take my brother. And I fought this thing night after night after night after night till finally my mother listened to me and we moved out of the house, and then it stopped.
So what do you think? Back in the United States, in, at home, when you were a child?
No, this was back in Canada, in Regina, in Saskatoon, where I was born.
Oh, I see. I thought you were born in the U.S. I misunderstood you.
No, I was born in Canada.
So what did you think would have happened had it taken her?
Taken my brother?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean,
it
didn't him.
Look, him. It didn't look like it had very, I don't know. It looked like it was trying, I think back about it, and I try to figure it out. My brother is extremely intelligent, and I notice that a lot of times these things look for intelligence. They're very drawn to people with high IQs, and they're above average intelligence. And my brother is one of those eccentric geniuses. And this thing wanted him very badly, just for that reason. I always got that feeling about it. Hey, so I've always been very protective of him. And I've seen something that in the movies that was somewhat similar to what I'd seen as a kid. And that was in the movie Stephen King's Cat's Eye. There is the little dwarf thing that comes in and tries to steal the baby's breath, and the cat saves him, saves the baby. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
No, movie, I haven't.
But that's the closest I've ever seen that ever even came. So I am convinced Stephen King knows what I'm talking about.
I think he does, too, for other reasons, but go ahead.
Yes. So that's another story. So I've been drawn into this for a long time, searching for answers to things. I'm open-minded to this stuff.
Life.
So you asked.
No, go ahead.
So you asked me how I'm involved in this, and I think I've actually become involved in this as being sort of the messenger to bring the story. They have actually used me as a messenger, I think.
And I think you've made a very good beginning at telling this message, too, because this has been an extraordinary experience for me, and I'm sure for my listeners as well. And I want to thank you for having come with this message.
Well, I thank you very much for interviewing me. I know you do have some very specific things that generally your interviewees have to have, like written a book or something like that, you know, and I haven't done anything. I've only come with this story, and this is probably the most unusual story I've ever run across with. And it's also the biggest. I've never heard of so many. The numbers of people disappearing here are very high in relation to other things. I mean, when we hear of abductions in Canada and the States and North America, we're talking maybe of incidents of one or two, maybe at the most, not very many. But there, it's happening so often. Here, it's happening in Bali and in Indonesia. It's happening so often that they're resigned to it.
And the interesting thing is that here, practically nobody is recorded as disappearing. People may disappear, but if they do, they are people who are in the wind, homeless people and stuff. They're not people like who live in families and things. If that was happening, well, I would know, but there it's different, apparently.
Yes, there it's different. They do have family, but the families also move on with their life. Like, this is a part of something that happens. Over once in a while, one of their family disappears in the jungles or in the mountains. It's just a fact of life with these people. They don't even really like to talk about it. And the funny thing is they were surprised I took it so seriously. They said, why do you want to know this stuff? And sometimes they would get a little bit upset because it's almost like they don't want to talk. It's almost like it's hidden. They don't want to talk about it. It's underneath. It's a sub, you know, it's just under the current. They don't really want to talk about it, but it's something that they're willing to admit it, but they don't want to really talk about it that much. Why do you want to know? Why do you want to know this? Do you want to bring them? Do you want to anger them? What do you want to do? Because I even offered to go into the jungle and look for these things. And they told me I was crazy.
Yeah,
I'd be crazy to go look
I think
for
you
these
might
things.
Be.
But I mean, you know, I what the heck is this, I'm thinking. So it's not going to stop. And whatever it is, it's been harvesting people for a long time.
Alan Lammers, way out on the edge of the world, a remarkable man on an extraordinary journey. If you're on an equally extraordinary journey, I know there are a lot of you out there. Always write Whitley@Strieber.com. Your journey will not get lost. Alan, I would like to thank you for being with us, and please, as this story develops, and I know it will develop, keep me informed, and we will have you back as often as we can. So thank you so much for your time and effort and sitting down all the way over there in Bali, talking to us via the remarkable power of the Internet. It sounds like you're right in the room with me.
Yes, thank you very much, Whitley. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, too. It was absolutely awesome talking to you. So thanks very much. And, folks, we will be back, as always, next week with another edition of Dreamland. Where from and who with? Well, you really, genuinely, with this program, just never know. Next week's Dreamland is going to be really incredible, folks. First, Linda Moulton Howe is going to be with us with a foretaste of what she's going to be doing for the Dreamland Festival, the RAF Bentwater story. She's blown this wide open after more than 20 years of research. You will hear interviews that you, unlike anything you've ever heard before from any military officer anywhere. Then David Serrada is going to be with us talking about consciousness in a whole new way. He's one of those magical, special people that you find only on Dreamland. So don't miss it next week.
This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge. Don't miss a single week and tell your friends about our unique program. Our Dreamland crew is Evan Ross on sound, Dana Augustine on program art, Daniel Stegall, webmaster, and I'm your Dreamland announcer, Brian Arnold. Thank you very much for listening.